Okay, well, welcome everybody to Jung in a Day. We're going to try and cram everything Jung said into 5 hours, which is all 40 volumes. Kind of an ambitious project. Normally, I take 16 hours to do this, but I thought, given that we introduced so many difficult concepts at Spirit in Place, that we could give folks a follow-up to at least get you grounded in the basics. Because it is a condensed course, some things will have to be sacrificed. The one thing I think I will try and entertain questions, but if you could keep them on clarification, or not like, oh, I don't agree with, or what are the implications of, we just don't have time for further discussion. Normally, too, I would take time get to know everybody, but I think that will not be a good use of time from the point of view of information. So I'm going to try to condense it down as simply as possible. I'm going to assume you know nothing. We're going to start from the very beginning and then build up. On the study guide, you can see the rough outline for today, and maybe you could just read through that. We're going to start off with a movie of Jung being interviewed in 1961. I'll talk about his life and times. We'll talk a great deal on dream interpretation. We're going to actually spend a disproportionate amount of time on dream interpretation. Why? Because that is the end point of every idea we work with. Everything Jung wrote, from the most basic to the most sublime mythological and historical analysis, comes out of work with dreams. So I thought it would be very important that you get a sense of what the end of that is. So we're going to start with that. We're going to start with, how do you interpret a dream? Probably spend most of the morning on it. Then we'll talk about the major parts of the personality that he has laid out, the shadow, animus. We'll talk about what a symbol is, persona, the unconscious, archetype, and the self and the mandala. Look a little bit about religion, his views on religion and alchemy. The one thing we are not going to do is typology, because it's the one thing in Jungian psychology that's clear. If you want to read up on it, there's a wonderful little book that is easily understandable called Please Understand Me by Kiersey, K-E-I-R-S-E-Y, and Bates, B-A-T-E-S. We will not be talking about typology. So without further ado, we're going to start off with an interview of Jung, 1959, 2 years before he died. Get a feeling for the man, and then we'll leap right into dream work. We will take a break halfway through the morning. We'll take a break halfway through the afternoon. We'll finish at 3:30. We'll take an hour for lunch.
Switzerland. Carl Gustav Jung, born in 1875. With Freud, one of the founding fathers of modern psychology. Still working at 84, he is the most honored living psychiatrist, and history will record him as one of the greatest physicians of all time.
How many years have you lived in this lovely house by the lake at Zurich?
It's just about 50 years.
Do you live here now just with your secretaries and your English housekeeper?
Yes.
No children or grandchildren with you?
Oh, no, they don't live here. But I have plenty of them in the surroundings.
Do they come to see you often?
Oh, yes.
How many grandchildren have
you? Oh, 19.
And great-grandchildren?
I think eight, and I suppose one is on the way.
And do you enjoy having them?
Well, of course it's nice to feel such a living crowd out of oneself.
Are they afraid of you, do you think?
I don't think so. If you would know my grandchildren, they wouldn't think so. I steal my things. Even my hat that belongs to me that I stole the other day.
Now, can I take you back to your own childhood? Do you remember the occasion when you first felt consciousness of your own individual self?
That was in my 11th year. There I suddenly, on my way to school, I stepped out of a mist. It was just as if I had been in a mist, walking in a mist, and I stepped out of it, and I knew I am. I am what I am. And then I thought, but what have I been before? And then I found that I had been in a mist, not knowing to differentiate myself from things. I was just one thing among many things.
Now, was that associated with any particular episode in your life, or was it just a normal function of adolescence?
Well, that's difficult to say. As far as I can remember, nothing had happened before that would explain this sudden coming to consciousness.
You hadn't, for instance, been quarreling with your parents or
anything? No.
What memories have you of your parents? Were they strict and old-fashioned in the way they brought you up?
Oh, well, you know, they belonged to the later parts of the Middle Ages. And my father was a parson in the country, and you can imagine what people were then, you know, in the 70s of the past century. They had the convictions in which people have lived since 1,800 years.
How did he try to impress these convictions on you? Did he punish you, for instance?
Oh, no, not at all. No, he was very liberal, and he was most tolerant, most understanding.
Which did you get on with more intimately, your father or your mother?
That's difficult to say. Of course, one is always more intimate with the mother. But when it comes to the personal feeling, I had a better relation to my father, who was predictable, than with my mother, who was, to me, very problematical something.
So, at any rate, fear was not an element in your relation with your father?
Not at all.
Did you accept him as being infallible in his judgments?
Oh, no, I knew he was very fallible.
How old were you when you knew that?
Now, let me see. Perhaps 11 or 12 years old. It was hanging together with the fact that I knew I was. And from then on, I saw that my father is different.
Yes. So the moment of self-revelation was closely connected with realizing the fallibility of your parents.
Yes, one could say so.
Now, what about...
I realized that I had fear of my mother, but not during the day. There she was quite known to me and predictable, but in the night I had fear of my mother.
And can you remember why? Can you remember what that
fear... I have not the slightest idea why.
No. What about your school days now? Were you happy at school as a school boy?
In the beginning I was very happy to have companions, you know, because before I had been very lonely. We lived in the country, and I had no brother and no sister. My sister was born very much later, when I was 9 years old. And so I was used to be alone, but I missed it. I missed company. And in school it was wonderful to have company. But soon, you know, in a country school, naturally, I was far ahead. And then I began to be bored.
What sort of religious upbringing did your father give you?
Oh, we were Swiss Reformed.
And did he make you attend church regularly?
Oh, well, that was quite natural.
Yes.
Everybody went to church
yes.
on Sunday.
And did you believe in God?
Oh, yes.
Do you now believe in God?
Now? I know. I don't need to believe. I know.
Well, now, turning to the next staging point in your life, what made you decide to become a doctor?
That was, in the first place, a merely opportunistic choice. I really, originally, I wanted to be an archaeologist. Assyriology, Egyptology, or something of the sort. I hadn't the money. The study was too expensive. So, my second love then belonged to nature, particularly zoology. And when I began my studies, I inscribed in the so-called philosophical faculty two, that means natural sciences. But then I soon saw that the post of the career that was before me would make a schoolmaster of me. I never thought I had any chance to get any further because we had no money at all. And then I saw that didn't suit my expectations. You know, I didn't want to become a schoolmaster. Teaching was not just what I was looking for. And so I remember that my grandfather has been a doctor, and I knew that when I was studying medicine, I had a chance to study natural sciences and to become a doctor, and a doctor can develop, you see, he can have a practice, he can do, he can choose his scientific interests more or less. At other ones, I would have more chance than being a schoolmaster. Also, the idea of doing something useful with human beings appealed to me.
And did you, when you decided to become a doctor, have difficulty in getting the training at school and in passing the exams?
I particularly had a difficulty with certain teachers that didn't believe that I could write a decent thesis. I remember one case where the teacher had the custom to, the habit to discuss the papers written by the pupils, and he took the best first, and he went through the whole number of the pupils, and I didn't appear, and I was badly troubled over it, and I thought, well, it is impossible that my thesis can be that bad. And when he had finished, he said, there is still one paper left over, and that is the one by Jung. That would be by far the best paper if it hadn't been copied. He has just copied it somewhere, stolen. You are a thief, Jung. And if I knew where you had have stolen it, I would fling you out of school. And I was mad, and I said, this is the one thesis where I have worked the most, because the theme was interesting, in contradistinction, you know, to other themes which are not at all interesting to me. And then he said, you are a liar, and if you can prove that you have stolen that thing somewhere, then you get out of school. Now, that was a very serious thing to me, because what else then, you see? And I hated that fellow, and that was the only man I could have killed, you know. If I had met him once at a dark corner, I would have shown him something of what I could do.
Did you often have violent thoughts about people when you were young?
No, not exactly. Only when I got mad. Well, then I beat them up.
And did you often get mad?
Not so often, but then for good.
You were very strong and big, I imagine.
Yes, I was pretty strong. And you know,
reared in the country with those peasant boys, it was a rough kind of life. And I would have been capable of violence. I know. I was a bit afraid of it. So I rather tried to avoid the critical situations because I didn't trust myself. Once I was attacked by about seven boys. And I got mad. And I took one and just swung him round with his legs, you know, and beat down four of them. And then they were satisfied.
And were there any consequences from that after?
Oh, I should say, yes. From then on, I was always suspected that I was at the bottom of every trouble. I was not, but they were afraid, and I was never attacked again.
Well, now, when the time came that you qualified as a doctor, what made you decide to specialize in being an alienist?
Yeah, that is rather an interesting point. When I had finished my studies practically, and when I didn't know what I really wanted to do, I had a big chance to follow one of my professors. He was called to a new position in Munich, and he wanted me as his assistant. But then, in that moment, I studied for my final examination. I came across the textbook, a textbook of psychiatry. Up to then, I thought nothing about it, because our professor then wasn't particularly interesting. And I only read the introduction to that book, where certain things were said about psychosis as a maladjustment of the personality. That hit the nail on the head. In that moment, I saw I must become an alienist. My heart was thumping wildly in that moment. And when I told my professor I wouldn't follow him, I would study psychiatry, he couldn't understand it. No, my friends, because in those days psychiatry was nothing at all. But I saw one great chance to unite certain contrasting things in myself, namely, beside medicine, beside natural science, I always had studied history of philosophy and such subjects. It was just as if suddenly two streams were joining.
And how long was it after you took that decision that you first came in contact with Freud?
Oh, you know, that was at the end of my studies, and then it took quite a while until I met Freud. You see, I finished my studies in 1900, and I met Freud only very much later. In 1900, I already read his Tribet interpretation and the boy of Freud studies about hysteria, but that was merely literary, you know. And then in 1907, I became acquainted with him personally.
Would you tell me how that happened? Did you go to Vienna?
Oh, well, I'd written a book about the psychology of dementia praecox, as we called schizophrenia then. I sent him that book, and thus became acquainted. I went to Vienna for a fortnight then, and then we had a very long and penetrating conversations. And that settled it.
And this long and penetrating conversation was followed by personal friendship?
Oh, yes. It soon developed into a personal friendship.
And what sort of man was Freud?
Well, he was a complicated nature, you know. I liked him very much. But I soon discovered that when he had thought something, then it was settled. While I was doubting all along the line. And it was impossible to discuss something really a fond. You know, he had no philosophical education, particularly I was studying Kant, and I was steeped in it, and that was far from Freud. So, from the very beginning, there was a discrepancy.
Did you, in fact, grow apart later, partly because of a difference in temperamental approach to experiment and proof and so on?
Well, of course, there is always a temperamental difference. And his approach was naturally different from mine because his personality was different from mine. That led me into my later investigation of psychological types. There are definite attitudes. Some people are doing it in this way and other people are doing it in another typical way. And there were such differences between myself and Freud too.
Do you consider that Freud's standard of proof and experimentation was less high than your own?
Well, you see, that is an evaluation I'm not competent of. I am not my own history or my historiographer. In with reference to certain results, I think my method has its merits.
Tell me, did Freud himself ever analyze you?
Yes, I had submitted quite a lot of my dreams to him, and so did he.
And he to you, yes?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Do you remember now, at this distance of time, what were the significant features of Freud's dreams that you noted at the time?
Well, that is rather indiscreet to ask. You know, there is such a thing as a professional secret.
He'd been dead these many years.
These regards last longer than life. I prefer not to talk about it.
Well, may I ask you something else then, which perhaps is also indiscreet? Is it true that you have a very large number of letters which you exchanged with Freud, which are still unpublished?
Yes.
When are they going to be published?
Well, not during my lifetime.
You would have no objection to them being published after your lifetime?
Oh, no, not at all.
Because they are probably of great historical importance.
I don't think so.
Then why have you not published them so far?
Because they were not important to me enough. I see no particular importance in them.
They are concerned with personal matters?
Well, partially. But I wouldn't care to publish them.
Well, now, can we move on to the time when you did eventually part company with Freud? It was partly, I think, with the publication of your book, The Psychology of the Unconscious. Is that correct?
That was the real cause.
Well, now, before you...
The final cause, because it had a long preparation. You know, from the beginning, I had a reservatio mentalis. I couldn't agree with quite a number of his ideas.
Which ones in particular?
Well, chiefly his purely personal approach and his disregard of the historical conditions of man. You see, we depend largely upon our history. We are shaped through education, through the influence of the parents, which are by no means always personal. They were prejudiced or they were influenced by historical ideas or what I call dominance. And that is a most decisive factor in psychology. And we are not of today or of yesterday. We are of an immense age.
Was it not partly your observation, your clinical observation of psychotic cases, which led you to differ from Freud on this?
It was partially my experience with schizophrenic patients that led me to the idea of certain general historical conditions.
Is there any one case that you can now look back on and feel that perhaps it was the turning point of your thought?
Oh, yes. I made quite a number of experiences of that sort, and I went even to Washington to study Negroes at the psychiatric clinic there in order to find out whether they have the same type of dreams as we have. And these experiences and others led me then to the hypothesis that there is an impersonal stratum in our psyche. And I can tell you an example. We had a patient in the ward. He was quiet but completely dissociated, schizophrenic. And he was in the clinic already for over 20 years. He had come into the clinic, as a matter of fact, being a young man, a little arrogant, and did no particular education. And once I came to the ward, and he was obviously excited and called to me, took me by the lapel of my coat and led me to the window and said, "Doctor, now you see. Now look at it. Look up at the sun and see how it moves. See, you must move your head too, like this, and then you will see the follows of the sun. And, you know, that's the origin of the wind. And you see how the sun moves as you move your head from one side to the other." Now, of course, I didn't understand it at all. I thought, oh, there you are. He's just crazy. But that case remained in my mind. And 4 years later, I came across a paper written by the German historian E. Dietrich, who had dealt with the so-called Mithras liturgy, a part of the great Parisian social papyrus. And there he produced the a part of the so-called Mithras liturgy. Namely, it is said there, "After the second prayer, thou wilt see how the disk of the sun unfolds. And you will see hanging down from it the tube, the origin of the wind. And when you move thy face to the regions of the east, it will move there. And if you move your face to the region of the west, it will follow you." And instantly, I knew, now this is it. This is the vision of my patient.
But how could you be sure that your patient wasn't unconsciously recalling something that somebody had told him?
Oh, no, quite out of question, because that thing was not known. It was in a magic papyrus in Paris, and it wasn't even published. It was only published 4 years later after I had observed it with my patient.
And this, you felt, proved that there was an unconscious, which was something more than personal.
Oh, well, that was not a proof to me, but it was a hint. And I took the hint.
Now, tell me, how did you first decide to start your work on the psychological types? Was that also as a result of some particular clinical experience?
Less so. It was a very personal reason. Namely, to do justice to the psychology of Freud, also to that of Adler, and to find my own bearings. That helped me to understand why Freud developed such a theory, or why Adler developed his theory, his power principle.
Have you concluded what psychological type you are yourself?
Naturally, I have devoted a great deal of attention to that painful question, you know.
And reached a conclusion?
Well, you see, the type is nothing static. It changes in the course of life. But I most certainly was characterized by thinking. I always thought, from early childhood on. And I had a great deal of intuition, too. And I had a definite difficulty with feeling. And my relation to reality was not particularly brilliant. I was often at variance with the reality of things. Now that gives you all the necessary data for a diagnosis.
During the 1930s, when you were working a lot with the German patients, you did, I believe, forecast that a second world war was very likely. Well, now, looking at the world today, you feel that a third world war is likely.
I have no definite indications in that respect. But there are so many indications that one doesn't know what one sees. Is it trees or is it the wood? It's very difficult to say because the dreams of people's dreams contain apprehensions, you know. But it is very difficult to say whether they point to a war, because that idea is uppermost in people's mind. Formerly, you know, it has been much simpler. People didn't think of a war. And therefore, it was rather clear what the dreams meant. Nowadays, no more so. We are so full of apprehensions, fears, that one doesn't know exactly to what it points. One thing is sure, a great change of our psychological attitude is imminent. That is certain.
Why?
Because we need more. We need more psychology. We need more understanding of human nature, because the only real danger that exists is man himself. He is the great danger. And we are pitifully unaware of it. We know nothing of man, far too little. His psyche should be studied, because we are the origin of all coming evil.
Well, does man, do you think, need to have the concept of sin and evil to live with? Is this part of our nature?
Well, obviously.
And of a redeemer?
That is an inevitable consequence.
This is not a concept which will disappear as we become more rational. It's something...
Well, I don't believe that man ever will deviate from the original pattern of his being. There will always be such ideas. For instance, if you do not directly believe in a personal redeemer, as it was the case with Hitler, or the hero worship in Russia, then it is an idea. It is a symbolic idea.
You have written one time and another some sentences which have surprised me a little about death. Now, in particular, I remember you've said that death is psychologically just as important as birth. And like it, it's an integral part of life. But surely it can't be like birth if it's an end, can it?
Yes, if it's an end. And there we are not quite certain about this end. Because, you know, there are these peculiar faculties of the psyche that it isn't entirely confined to space and time. You can have dreams or visions of the future. You can see round corners and such things. Only ignorance deny these facts. It's quite evident that they do exist and have existed always. Now these facts show that the psyche, in part at least, is not dependent upon these confinements. And then what? When the psyche is not under that obligation to live in time and space alone, and obviously it doesn't, then to that extent the psyche is not submitted to those laws. And that means a practical continuation of life, of a sort of psychical existence beyond time and space.
Do you yourself believe that death is probably the end, or do you believe that?
Well, I can't say. You see, the word belief is a difficult thing for me. I don't believe. I must have a reason for a certain hypothesis. Either I know a thing, and when I know it, I don't need to believe it. If I don't allow myself, for instance, to believe a thing just for the sake of believing it, I can't believe it. But when there are sufficient reasons for a certain hypothesis, I shall accept these reasons, naturally. I should say, we have to reckon with the possibility of so-and-so, you know.
Well, now, you told us that we should regard death as being a goal.
Yes.
And that to shrink away from it is to evade life and
yes.
Life purposes.
Yes.
What advice would you give to people in their later life to enable them to do this, when most of them must in fact believe that death is the end of everything? Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, I have treated many old people, and it's quite interesting to watch what the unconscious is doing with the fact that it is apparently threatened with a complete end. It disregards it. It life behaves as if it were going on. And so I think it is better for old people to live on, to look forward to the next day, as if he had to spend centuries. And then he lives properly. But when he is afraid, when he doesn't look forward, he looks back, he petrifies, he gets stiff and he dies before his time. But when he is living on, looking forward to the great adventure that is ahead, then he lives. And that is about what the unconscious is intending to do. Of course, it's quite obvious that we are all going to die, and this is the sad finale of everything. Nevertheless, there is something in us that doesn't believe it, apparently. But this is merely a factor, a psychological fact. It doesn't mean to me that it proves something. It is simply so. For instance, I may not know why we need salt, but we prefer to eat salt too, because you feel better. And so when you think in a certain way, you may feel considerably better. And I think if you think along the lines of nature, then you think properly.
And this leads me to the last question that I want to ask you. As the world becomes more technically efficient, it seems increasingly necessary for people to behave communally and collectively. Now, do you think it's possible that the highest development of man may be to submerge his own individuality in a kind of collective consciousness?
That's hardly possible. I think there will be a reaction. A reaction will set in against this communal dissociation. You know, man doesn't stand forever his nullification. Once there will be a reaction. And I see it setting in, you know, when I think of my patients, they all seek their own existence and to assure their existence against that complete atomization into nothingness or into meaninglessness. Man cannot stand a meaningless life.
Well, there was Jung 2 years before his death. And let's take a quick look now at the main stages of his life and where some of those ideas that we're talking about today are going to fit into his life. As they said in the movie, he was born in 1875 in North East Switzerland. When he was three, his family moved to Basel. Basel is northwest Switzerland. He became a doctor, and in 1907 met Freud. That's probably the first really big landmark. They worked together for about 5, 6 years, and they split in 1913. I always say I think the biggest reason they split is that Freud was an atheist and Jung was not. There are many other reasons, but that's tried summing it up very succinctly. Certainly, as you could tell, Jung learned a great deal from Freud. Freud was a generation older than Jung. And they both had stumbled independently on this concept of the unconscious, which is something we'll be talking about later this afternoon. And I think no one in the mental health field had really developed that concept before them. So that collaboration was very important. Another really big moment in Jung's life really was his residency in Zurich at the psychiatric clinic. His boss was a man named Eugen Bleuler. And Bleuler is the guy who changed the word dementia praecox to schizophrenia. Before that time, before around 1910, 1907, somewhere in there, people thought that schizophrenia was an organic disturbance and it was hopeless. Dementia is like dementia, and praecox is early. So they thought it was an organic disturbance. So these people were written off. And Bleuler then, with Jung as his assistant, threw out that understanding, which American psychiatry still has not caught up with, that schizophrenia is a psychological malady. So he was right there with Freud developing his ideas. He was right there with Bleuler developing ideas. So he was really at the cutting edge of the birth of psychology. Something happened from 1913 to 1928, which is really important for what's going to be following. He, with the loss of contact with Freud, he lost his orientation. He was teaching at the University of Zurich, resigned his position. He kept up his work as a psychiatrist. He was a father of five. But other than that, he withdrew his interest from the outer world and went through a kind of dark night of the soul. He was depressed. He was confused. He didn't know where he stood. But as he focused on his own personal suffering during that time, he watched something happen inside himself, which is really the foundation of his major contribution to psychology. He watched himself fall apart. He watched that falling apart symbolized in dreams by images of fragmentation. And then he watched himself being put back together again. And when all those pieces came back together again, he found his self-confidence had returned, and he had developed an alternative to Freud's psychology, which then became the basis of Jungian psychology. The word for this discovery is the self. We'll be talking about the self later this afternoon. The big deal here is where Freud was thinking, you have to make the unconscious conscious. If you have a problem, you have to get in there, look at what's behind it, bring it up into consciousness. And what Jung felt was, no, there is an inborn healing process apart from the will. We don't go into the unconscious and make it conscious. We try to locate this inner healing process, which is a process of synthesis, and bring ourselves back together by cooperating with it. So where Freud thought that we are born empty and we only are what we have imbibed through life, Jung felt that we are born with something, this inner capacity to heal ourselves, which will be the subject of this afternoon's material. So 1928, by 1928, he was 53 years old. He basically had his feet on the ground. And for the next 15, 16 years, just worked as a psychiatrist, documenting in his own dreams and in his clients' dreams and in any system of mythology he could get his hands on, how this process of synthesis works. He went to his patients' dreams, he went to myth, and he was wondering if it was just a culturally relative process. But in 1928, when he was 53, he got a text from China, make a long story short, which showed the process of enlightenment in the same metaphor he had been using for his process of healing. And that gave him the confidence to say that what he stumbled on was not culturally relative. It was an inborn human capacity. worked then till 1944 just collecting data from dreams and looking for parallels in myths to help understand all the various images that appear to demonstrate and to symbolize this process. Maybe you can see right off the bat, if you're working with a model that you have to do everything to make the unconscious conscious, versus there is a process in the unconscious that is working that we have to cooperate with, the therapeutic approach, practically speaking, is quite different. We try, rather than to make something happen in the individual, to hear where that process is going. We don't have the patient's client sitting on a couch. We go face to face because the most important thing is the personal relationship, which Jung feels activates this process, this healing process. So out of this theoretical discovery came a practical shift in the way he understood therapy. Again, we'll be looking at all that in detail. That's basically the main contribution. He worked just collecting data until 1944. When he was 69, he had a heart attack. And he almost died, came back, realized he had a second lease on life. And for the next 16, 17 years, began to write more directly from the point of view of what he was discovering in these images, in myths, and dreams. His earlier stuff tries to take the reader's point of view in mind. The later stuff, he says, well, I could be dead, so why don't I just tell it like it is? And those books are then going to be the subject of another series of workshops starting in January and February, going for the next 18 months. That's in the back of your study guide. They are more difficult to read, but they are certainly the most interesting part of Jung, where he really condenses everything he had seen in the nature of unconscious imagery and begins to explain it, making us do the work. And I tell you, I myself could not do it without the very helpful commentary of a man named Edward Ettinger, who has published study guides on all of those major works. So that will be something we'll be looking at in the next 18 months. Another big idea, which I will just mention very briefly, we won't be talking about it too much on this evening, though if you were at Spirit and Place, I did allude to it quite a bit, is this idea of synchronicity. What Jung observed in this process, when people are engaged with the images and with the struggle to put themselves back together, which is led by the unconscious but still requires their cooperation, is that images that appear in dreams start appearing in outer reality at the same time. That's what he calls a synchronicity. In other words, the dreams apparently do not only occur on the inside. This is a later, something we'll take up in the very, very last series of those workshops we do. I just wanted to point up to you, there's another big idea, that this dream process, because images that appear inside also appear outside, makes us reevaluate just about every assumption of Western science and Western philosophy. A quick example, I gave one example at Spirit and Place, but a very quick example that happened not too long ago. A woman dreamt of a bear claw, bears giving swats. So we talked about the meaning of that bear in her dreams. Her mother was very passive, and the bear is a well-known mother symbol in myth. And so we discussed the bear as the kind of mothering she never got to teach her how to fend for herself, slap back, metaphorically speaking, when necessary, fight back, and stand up for herself. 2 days later, she went to Joanne Fabrics and was standing in line to pay for some fabric. And she looked over her shoulder, and the woman in front of her had a handful of buttons with bear claws on them. This kind of thing happens in the inner journey quite frequently, an inner image reflected on the outside. That's what Jung calls synchronicity, and that was one of the things he focused on at the end of his life. We'll get to that eventually. That's more Jung 300, and we're still at Jung 100. So that's basic Jung's life. If you want to study more beyond what we're doing today, I've tried to give you a list of resources. There are URLs at the back, page 4 of the study guide, to my website, where I've given you several different sheets with books to read, starting with the most simple up to the more complicated. I'll let you follow that up yourself. Now to dreams. The subtitle of this workshop could be Everything You Need to Know About Jungian Psychology You Can Learn from a Gyroscope. So I want to do a little experiment. I think it's easier to show you what a dream is about than to talk about it. And I need to get this thing spinning. It just takes a minute. It's going up to speed. Maybe you could be our guinea pig. What I want you to do is feel what it's like to try to move a spinning gyroscope. And then tell the people now, just try to move it in the axis of the now hold it up here. It's not that strong a gyroscope. Now just try to turn it that way. What do you feel? No, back and forth.
A lot of resistance.
Right.
Lots and lots of resistance.
Lots of resistance. Yeah. That's what a dream is.
Doesn't turn easily.
That's what a dream is. If she tries to turn it this way, it won't even let me turn it. It's pushing back on this finger. If I try to turn it the other way, I can't even turn it without really a lot of effort. If I try to turn it that way, it pushes back on this finger to keep itself right. That's what a dream is. A dream is an inborn feedback loop whereby when you stray from who you are, it comes along and gives you a counter pressure to put you back in touch with your real self. When you stay on the other side, it will come along and give you a pressure to put you back to your real self. Very simple. If you are a person who's too nice, if you're nicer than your nature, your dreams will become dark to remind you you're too nice. If you're actually not a very nice person and you are straying from your nature, your dreams will come along and be very light to remind you to come back to your center. Jung's word for that is compensation. What the dream does, it compensates inaccurate attitudes of the conscious personality to try to bring you back in harmony with yourself. Now, where Freud thought that a dream was a wish fulfillment, that is, you know, if you wanted a stick of chewing gum and you didn't get the stick of chewing gum, you would dream of chewing gum that night. Actually, that's not quite accurate, because for him, these wishes were all sexual. So when there was something about eros or sexuality that you were denying, that wish would appear in the unconscious. So for Freud, this whole thing is a biological idea. For Jung, it's existential. There is a big implication to what I said, which is that there is a person for you to be. Remember I said if I turn it, it tries to write itself up to the axis it was. If I try to turn it the other way, now it's winding down, it will try to push itself back to its original axis. So one of the key ideas in Jung that we're going to come to this afternoon, it's this idea of the self, is that there is somebody to be, and that somebody to be is something you are born with. So this very simple idea of dreams actually makes us take account of a very complicated religious, philosophical, existential concept that you are somebody. And you're here to be somebody. And when you stray from that, the dreams come along to give you a message to put you back to that center. So the key word here for Jung is compensation, where for Freud it's wish fulfillment. Now let's look a little bit how that works. this next part of the basics of dream interpretation from Jung's point of view actually is not his idea. It's actually Aristotle's idea. And he takes the method of unraveling a dream from the Poetics, Aristotle's Poetics, where Aristotle lays out the three components of drama. And it's actually not very complicated. There's a beginning, there's a middle, and there's an end. The beginning presents an issue. So the first sentence, certainly within the first couple of sentences, the dream is presenting something at stake. Very often it's a problem, a concern. Something is wrong. I don't mean morally wrong, but out of kilter and needing to be addressed. The second part, and by the way, this is true for a symphony. This is true for a novel. This is true for a play. It's about something. It's about some concern. The middle part of a dream can be looked at in a couple of different ways. It is very often the complications you are likely to expect from that beginning scene. Or it usually contains the steps that you are or are not going to take to address the beginning issues. The end of the dream is a representation of the outcome of that problem addressed in this way, leading to such and such an end. So here you see is where free choice has a chance. It's a negative looking dream, you know, and the house blew up. Need not be a fait accompli. It can be that given this issue, if you deal with it in this way or you avoid dealing with it in this way, here's going to be the outcome. So that's the dramatic structure. Each dream is a little drama. I think that might give you some reason to understand, just in a general sense, why culture is so important. What stories do, they resonate with this. I think that's why we're so attracted to them. Now we'll go through two dreams in a minute to show you how this all works. I'm just giving you the theory for the moment. And what I brought along is I brought along a dream where there's a response to the problem, and I brought along a dream where there's an avoidance of the problem. So what we're doing in our work, we're always watching how is the dreamer responding to the issue that's being put to them. And that issue that's being put to them is what they need to know to come back to that person they are here to be. The next important detail, I think, would be the method of going through each image in the dream and trying to understand what it's pointing to. Jung's basic assumption, and this is basic, but it's not always the case, and when it's not the case, it's one of the biggest problems in our work. But generally, I think you can say that what those images in a dream represent are personifications of your own personality. So if you have a dream of a dog, that dog is something dog-like in you. If you have a dream of a cat, that dream is something cat-like in you. How do we know what that dog and cat means in your dream? Well, we ask you. And that is called getting the association. The interpreter will ask the dreamer for their comment on each of the main images in the dream. For example, let's say I have a dream of a dog, and I might say, oh, dogs, you know, I love dogs. Growing up, we always had dogs. They were my best friends. They were very affectionate. I might ask somebody else about dog, and they might say, ooh, dogs, I don't like dogs. They're aggressive, and I was bit when I was a kid, and I don't like them. I'm afraid of them. you can see what that dog means in each person's dream is going to be completely different. And the meaning of that image, the meaning of what that image points to in their personality is going to be different based on what they say. In the first case, I would say something like, the dog would represent my instinct for affection and affiliation. Does that make sense? The second case, I would say that dog represents the person's hostility, maybe their anger, maybe their attacking nature. So it is very important to hear the associations of the dreamer. Now, sometimes it's just plain old common sense. I brought along dreams to make us associate. I think you'll see very often it's common sense. But sometimes you really do need to sit down and hear what the dreamer says. There is another dimension to this work. And that is, sometimes the people have nothing to say about the image. It can very well be that they're blocking. That's one possibility. Another possibility is, now we get into a concept we'll be looking at this afternoon, another possibility is that image is in their dream, not by virtue of their personal experience of what that refers to. It's what Jung calls the collective unconscious. Jung does not feel that everything that is inside us is there by virtue of our having experienced it and having a personal comment on it. But we are born with a kind of mythological, or a structure for mythological portrayal. We are born with a readiness to produce certain images which you can find in reading the mythology of the culture you come from most directly. And the way we try to get at what that is not to ask the dreamer for the associations, but it's the therapist's job to go to the myth of their most immediate culture, and to the extent that we're all human, to world culture in general, looking how that image appears in myth. We'll be looking at a dream where there's a cat, and the dreamer didn't have much to say about cat. So we'll go to myth, and what if you look at most world myths, the cat is associated with the mother goddess. So it would have something to do with the dreamer's relationship to the maternal side of life. So they are the basic principles that the dreams compensate. Another way to think of that is they tell you what you need to know when you get off track, that the dreams have a structure, that the dreams represent parts of yourself, and you can understand what the part of yourself is by associations or by implication. Scott?
Would it be maybe a simple way to say that personal myth, in other words, good cat, bad cat, and good dog, bad dog interpretations, would be more the exception to the rule?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. The other exception is if you are in a relationship with somebody and you dream of them. Sometimes you are actually dreaming of the relationship and you're not dreaming of what they symbolize in yourself. That is the tough part of dream work. Sometimes you're not clear and you will say, well, if Jane is an inner Jane, what does it mean? Or if it's an outer Jane, what does it mean? Yeah.
What do you say to be the beginning of the dream? Because lots of times I'll have a dream and when I wake up, I know that there's been a part that I don't remember, and then at some point...
Well, this would apply to a fully remembered dream.
Okay, so you have to have the whole arc. Okay.
You often do just get a piece of a dream, and then you see you're in the middle, or you may just get the end, or you may get the beginning, or you may get a dream that doesn't end. That is not uncommon, which would tell you that you are not ready to recognize the solution to the problem, that you need to live on and develop further consciousness before you're ready. This is sort of the ideal. And I think, you know, if you ever woken up, you know, and it starts with a big dream, you'll see that it fits this category. But what you may remember in the morning very often could be one piece of this. Yeah?
What was the book by Aristotle?
The Poetics. This is his structure of tragic drama. Mm-hmm. Beginning, middle, and end. And it really does fit. A classic symphony, you know, starts out with two themes. They go through then theme one statement, theme two statement, then they clash, and then there's a synthesis. Same thing. presentation of the problem, a period of conflict, and then a resolution or not a resolution. Okay, let's go through some examples. You turn to your study guide. I've brought along several dreams. The first two we'll work through together. The next two are followed by questions, which you can work on at your leisure, and I've given you at the back of that study guide, I've given you the spot on my website where the answers are to the questions. So you can practice that. If we had more time, we'd break up into groups, but this is where I have to cut back. But you can try it on your own, the second two, and then see how you've done. Now, we don't have the Dreamers Association, but I brought along dreams that I think are pretty straightforward, that you'll find common sense will give you an association. So imagine, you know, it were your dream and you're associating to it, and I think we'll be all right. Also, what I've done, I've brought along in the first two dreams women with similar psychology. They're highly educated, rather intellectual women, and in their 50s. But there's a complete difference in the response, so to give you a contrast. So I'll read the dream, and then I'm going to ask you to not think about psychology. Think about Aristotle. Think about English literature, and break the dream up into its parts. And then we'll associate to it, and then we'll interpret it to give you a practical sense of what's going on here. First dream, I found some strange pieces of wood. Not carved, but with natural, beautiful shapes. Someone said, Neanderthal man brought them. Then I saw at a distance these Neanderthal men looking like a dark mass, but I could not see one of them distinctly. I thought I would take back from this place a piece of their wood. Then I went on as if on a journey by myself, and I looked down into an enormous abyss like an extinct volcano. There was water in part of it, and there I expected to see more Neanderthal men. But instead, I saw black water pigs that had come out of the water and were running in and out of the black volcanic rocks. Now, don't think psychology. Just think drama. And let's break that up into various parts. What's the issue? What is driving the dream? What's driving the action in the dream? Yeah. She has to fetch wood. She doesn't have to. She likes to fetch wood. What does she see after she decides to fetch wood? Before. Neanderthal man.
She doesn't decide to fetch the wood until after she sees it.
Okay. Now, what's next? She sees the dark abyss, which is an extinct volcano. And that's the end of the dream. Sorry? Right. And as far as I know, it don't exist. Okay, now, try associating to the wood. Try describing it. Naturally beautiful.
Must be small enough to carry.
Can you play this word a little bit more? I think that's the key word.
Not human shaped.
Right.
Okay.
It's not your shape. It's your shape. Apparently, it's been worn down by water or the elements. We could maybe just stop right there and interpret that. What's the issue? Well, the wood is going to be part of herself that she needs to recover. What part of herself does she need to recover?
Her natural self.
Her natural self, right. She is two cultures. Two cultures, two intellectual, two professional, and she's lost touch with her natural spontaneity. The Neanderthal men just really repeat that, because they are from the primal level of our heritage, pre-cultural. So these two really do fit together. But notice that she has acted to fetch the wood. That is very important. So she is given a challenge to get to know the natural side of herself, and she responds. Now, this is a little more difficult. This would be, I would call all of this the problem. The problem is to find and begin to recover her natural self out of being too intellectual, probably a little high society, a little too high society. This is going to be what she has to do in order to accomplish this feat. Now, imagine somebody doesn't know what a volcano is. This is sometimes a helpful little gimmick. Try to describe what a volcano is. What does a volcano do? Right. Now, interpret that. What in the human personality erupts? Emotion. What does that mean?
Channel to the underworld, to the heat below, to the channel.
But as far as we know, there's nothing there. She's cut off from her emotions. What would you expect somebody like this would tell you about the childhood? They had to be perfect. That her emotional self was made extinct in the process of growing up. So in order to get to her natural self, she's got to begin looking at the emotions which are extinct and recovering them. Now, again, there's no such thing as a black water pig as far as I know. Here, I personally would go to myth. And pigs like cats are generally sacred to the mother goddesses. So I'm thinking the person perhaps who taught her to squash her emotions comes from her mother. But there's a unique ending to it. The pigs go in and out of the volcano.
Well, there's
water. Or in and out of the water. What? But you see, it's an image of traversing two realms. The pigs go in and they come out. They go in and they come out. What do you think that's about? Right. And it's a shuttling process whereby he might have been too emotional. We don't know exactly. But in any case, her emotional self has been put to sleep, and now she has to go back into it and then find a way to relate it to daily life. It is not good enough just to have emotions that erupt the dreams. The dream is saying by that final image. She has to be able to take those emotions and transfer them to the world in some sort of a meaningful way.
And pigs are very solid. It's interesting because they're kind of like wood. You've never picked up a pig. They're made out of wood. And they're very fierce too. So they're not, you know, we're not talking here about wolf emotions or frog yeah. emotions. These are pretty substantial things.
They're also very intelligent.
Yeah.
All of that would be what she has to recover. But can you see how this is an answer to this and how this gets her from here to there? That's what I want you to see. There really is a structure. So we start with a structure, we then look at the associations, we reach the conclusions, and the compensatory meaning would be to tell her you need to become more natural. That that who she really is she has lost that in this kind of phony or whatever cultural, intellectual, professional self. And the message is, come back to this naturalness. That's the compensation. Happy with that? Second dream is a similar kind of woman, but it's a greatly different dream, and I brought it along as a contrast. Let's go through it again. We'll look at the structure, we'll look at associations and amplifications. And then we'll try interpretation. A villainous-looking man with a red face and battered look comes to me and summons me with threats to accompany him. Pretending to comply, I go with him into the street and then appeal to passers-by for help. He makes off with indignant haste, and I laugh mockingly. Then a group of people, the ones appealed to, are standing around. Various messengers keep coming at intervals, summoning away the men in the group. At last, one man is called away to a house opposite, and then a whole crowd of people come from the place to which he has gone, carrying an injured woman, her face distorted with pain. Okay, structure. Who can tell me? What's the beginning issue of the dream? What's he doing? Not forcing her. Well, I guess he is. Yes, even before that, he's summoning her. So she's got a summons. Well, a battered look. What'd she say? Villain. Villainous looking. Sorry? So she's summoned by a villainous looking man. Notice what she does. She pretends. See the difference? What you can get out of one sentence is amazing once you know this language. She pretends to comply, and then what does she do?
Well, she's looking for someone outside herself to help her, and then she, when he leaves, she mocks him. She doesn't take him to
And the very ending? There's a woman in pain. This is so obvious, I'm not sure how much we need to associate, but how about this? What quality would that show?
He means
their harm. Yes, but in terms of his own personality makeup, what would he be like? Deceitful, right? Dishonest. What she's being asked to look at? Her own dishonesty. Where do you see her own dishonesty in the dream? See how that works? You can start locating these images repeating themselves. So she's being asked to look at her dishonesty. she meets that request. So this is a compensatory message. Look at your dishonesty. You are not as good as you think you are. She probably has a high opinion of her moral self, and in fact, she has corners of her personality where she is not particularly honest. And we see her acting dishonestly in the dream itself. So you can see how the villain would personify her own tendency to funk situations with a trick. She appeals to help. How would she sound in therapy? Right. She would be blaming other people and looking to other people to solve her problem because she is not taking responsibility for an honest effort to address issues, and she probably has an arrogant strain to her as well. How about the end?
Causing her a lot of pain.
Right. This is her own pain. Now, this is not the reason I brought it along. First, to show you the difference between a second part of a dream where there is an adequate response to the challenge and a second part of a dream where there is an inadequate response to the challenge. But also to point up this difference, where in the first dream we had a challenge, a response, and a satisfactory solution. Here we have a challenge and an avoidance and a catastrophe. Now, it is not telling her this is the way your life has to be. But it is telling her, if you deal with this problem in this way, here's going to be the outcome of your life. It is not giving you something you can't change, but the destructive end is meant to bring you back to the middle of the dream to see, where am I not addressing the problem that started? And if I can understand this, I can change the ending into something positive. Make sense, everybody? That was easy. That's all you need to know about dream interpretation. Well, that went a little faster than I thought. Do you want to just take a minute? Maybe this side of the room. We won't do it out loud, but just read the first dream. I was in Paris. And the... see, what did I say? This side, Paris. This side, in the harbor. Read it, run through the questions, and then I'll put it up here.
Yeah. Is the fact that it was a man, does that indicate that this is her behavior in the more public realm, that is in a more visible realm than, say, if it were a woman that was battered, which would mean that that was sort of how she was on the inside and she might exhibit something different on the outside?
We'll get to that this afternoon. Very likely possible. I would say in general, yes, but here, again, I think you'd need associations to her. Yeah. If she said, you know, oh, yeah, this guy is a guy new in business, you'd be right. If she would say, oh, that's the Dalai Lama, it would be different. Ready to try it, or do you need more time?
Another
minute? Okay. Kate, why don't you read the first one for us?
Oh, okay. This is a dream by a female. I was in Paris walking down a boulevard with two women who were my age, perhaps they were my friends. We passed a large department store, and I persuaded my friends to join with me. The aisles were filled with displays of luxury items, all priced in price, which I had difficulty translating into dollars. There was this one handkerchief that had a black and white kitten finely embroidered on it. As I tell you this, it occurs to me that I was looking for a gift from my mother. That handkerchief was what I wanted. My great surprise, it cost $65. The dreamer continued to relate. And that reminds me, I got a letter from my mother the very next day telling me that they'd been adopted by a black and white kitten who showed up on their doorstep.
What's the issue?
Purchasing
a handkerchief in Paris. Where do things start to get a little difficult?
How much it costs,
and she's got to persuade friends to go in. That's really where the dream ends. So we really don't know whether she buys the handkerchief or not. But the end of the dream is what we would call a synchronicity. That cat actually shows up on the parent's doorstep. Again, the inner world appearing on the outer world, emphasizing the importance. Do you want to try and interpret it? Parents would be feeling, I'm making it very simple for the sake of our time limit, and so she has to make a purchase in a feeling area. Right. What's it mean to make a purchase in a feeling area, in a feeling place?
What?
Acquire her own ability to feel.
Well, why is Paris feeling?
Pardon me?
Why is Paris feeling?
Oh, you ever been to Paris?
Yeah.
You don't think it's feeling? City of romance? Charm? Good taste? That's what she has to develop. She has cancer, and she won't live long from this dream. So she's being asked to develop her feeling for what purpose? Has to do with the black and white cat.
The opposite.
The opposites together, why a cat?
Feminine.
Now, yeah, I think she's got to begin to see the two sides of her feelings for her mother, which were basically negative, to be able to go back to that mother knowing that there was good and bad and say goodbye. Establish the feeling relationship. That would be the purchase of the handkerchief in Paris. Develop the feeling capacity to let bygones be bygones and to say goodbye so that she could die peacefully.
Sure about that because the price
and in fact I don't think she did. The price was too high.
Also the translating from francs to dollars, it's hard to understand what she's going to have to pay because she's not much less.
Right. So the language of feeling isn't something she's comfortable with.
And she's holding on to worry about the price of things when you think that things are going to go on for a long time. If you realize that things are going to end quickly, you say, oh, what the hell? So she's still caught up in that old
possibly
old place.
I think more it was psychologically too much that she was physically suffering to also then mend fences with her mom so she could die peacefully. Okay, you follow that?
And isn't it that she's not sure about the value of this person is going back from French to dollars and back and forth?
I would say that I'm taking French as the language of feeling, and the franc is the currency of feeling, and she just doesn't know how to make the leap from ordinary, generic encounters to ones where the heart is really involved. That would be the French language and the French purpose.
I thought that odd, though, that they had been adopted by the cat. Not that they adopted the cat, they had been adopted by
Yes?
We don't know Captain. Okay. I'm in Paris this very morning. I had to find you.
Okay. I think it shows the... when certain psychological tasks are ripe for fulfillment, and if you're not used to this, it will sound very strange, but if you are used to it, I guess you'll be used to it, but the world starts acting on you in the strangest ways. And I don't want to get off on that too much now. It will be a future workshop. But... the conclusion is that dreams don't only occur inside us.
It's almost like the feeling part of her, the healing part of her, that black and white cat, which she can't do, gets transferred into an actual real cat. And because when I've had losses, and then a cat came literally a day before my other cat was killed. And so it's like something comes...
something else is going on.
...mitigate... the loss, so it's like there's been this transfer to the parents to mitigate her loss.
Or to convince her of the importance of what she's dealing with. Mm-hmm. See, it breaks your rational view of life. Mm-hmm. Okay, one more. I know we're going quickly, but I warned you that I'm trying to give you as much as possible in a short time. We could spend a whole day just on that dream, probably. Nancy, do you mind reading the next?
By a male. In the harbor of a little place not far from my home, on the shore of a lake in the neighborhood, locomotives and freight cars are being raised from the bottom of the lake where they have been sunk in the last war. First, a large cylinder like a locomotive boiler is brought up. Then, an enormous, rusty freight car. The whole picture represents a horrible, yet romantic sight. Then, the bottom of the lake changes into a green meadow.
You want to take a shot at it?
Yeah, it occurs to me that that the locomotive is all that he's been pulling in his past life.
It's buried.
It opens with these things that have been buried.
Buried, right. So what is he? What is he buried?
Power.
Power and power would be the locomotive. Look at the. Freight. Yeah, his good qualities. He's lost his power and he's lost his gifts for other people. He's an introverted, way over shy guy, we're told. But what he's doing is recovering. That would be the challenge. And then what happens when he can?
New life,
right. Life can become green again. Admittedly, I brought along simple dreams, but you can hopefully see there really is a logic to these. And that is enormously helpful in interpreting them. And the other key factor is the importance of associations and amplifications. Much of it is common sense, but you've got to be a little careful that you don't put your own values on somebody else's dream. That's why we proceed this way. I'm just trying to make it simple. Pardon?
The meaning of the locomotive.
Power. His own personal power. He was probably, we're told he was passive and shy and retiring.
Does it also mean devoid of feeling?
I don't think so. It could, but because the ending is so positive, I don't think so.
I was wondering if because the whole picture is so horrible and yet romantic that he was caught in sentimentality.
Yes. I mean, it's not without ambivalence. Right.
I was wondering maybe about even at the last war, that maybe whatever fight he had gotten into emotionally, he just buried himself.
I'm sure there was a huge fight with parents where he learned to bury himself. Definitely. Should we have a stretch? Then we'll come back and start with the shadow.